It's a great pleasure to be here, and I had my first opportunity to talk at a law school in many years, just last week to one of your competitors, it's a great experience to talk to law people, and I think in general the different professions think slightly differently. So it'll be wonderful to be here. I'm going to go through. There should be more than enough time at the end to ask questions. One of the things that Mimi didn't say is that I do a lot of empirical research as well as conceptual research, and I do a lot of surveys, and I like to survey doctors and patients and the public on a variety of things. So I want to start off here surveying you at the start, because it's going to be a very important lesson, I believe, when we get to the end, if you're as predictable as every group I've visited so far. Considering all aspects, how well do you think the American healthcare system functions? Very well? Raise your hand if you think it functions very well. None? Moderately well? No, fair number of people. Fairly well? No, moderately well might be the mode here. Not well at all? Very interesting. The reason moderately might be the mode in this class is you probably have very little interaction with the healthcare system. Second question, considering all aspects, how happy are you personally with the healthcare services that you personally receive? Very happy? Moderately happy? Fairly happy? Not happy at all. So notice that there's a big shift here to the very happy and moderately happy, away from the moderately and fairly happy. That dichotomy, that you think the system performs worse than your personal services, is a very important finding and one of the key barriers to have healthcare reform in this country. And we're going to come back to that at the end of the talk. This cartoon sums up my view of the healthcare system. Between congratulations and get well soon, it says, good luck with the American healthcare system. And that's pretty much as the way it is. The American healthcare system is really two systems combined. One is a financing system, the employer-based financing, Medicaid, Medicare, for how we pay for the system. That part is inefficient, inequitable, and increasingly fiscally unsustainable. And we'll highlight some of this as we go through. The delivery system, doctors, hospitals, pharmacists, home health care agencies, physical therapists, that system is very fragmented. It's not designed for the care of chronic disease, which accounts for 70 to 75% of the dollars spent. It provides haphazard and poor quality, and it has a high use of unproven and marginal therapies. Now, I would submit to you, and this may be one of the most important things I say tonight, that true healthcare reform has to fix both sides, the delivery side as well as the financing side. Because if you don't fix the delivery side, you cannot have a sustainable financial fix. Unfortunately, we've just gone through a year-long presidential campaign, and almost all of the debate and discussion has focused on financing and trying to get to universal coverage. Almost nothing has been said about fixing the delivery side of the equation. In the next year, as the country debates health care reform and the president and other members of Congress put forward proposals, you need to test them out and have this question. What do they do for the financing side, and how are they going to change the delivery side? This is a kind of litmus test for whether they're adequate reforms. Now, if I put you in a room and asked you, write down the goals for a good healthcare system, you could probably fill several pages with things that a good healthcare system should do. I've tried to distill them to my top seven. They may not be the top seven for all of you, and they're probably even at that too long. Certainly the top three are, I think, without dispute. We need a coverage system which has everyone in the system. We need cost control so we don't bankrupt ourselves. We need a high-quality delivery system. We also need, in my view, choice. In America, if you can go to the supermarket and buy, you know, one of 26 varieties of jams, one of 75 different cereals, it seems a little ludicrous not to have choice in the healthcare system, which is far more important than jam or cereal. We also want a system that has fair fiscal responsibility so that we don't have the poor supplementing the rich, which actually occurs in the current system. I think if you want to bring doctors along, you need malpractice reform. And finally, we want a healthcare system that helps the economy. Before I talk about various reforms, I think it's important to try to understand how our current system matches up against these seven goals. I'm not going to go through each one of them. I'll highlight a few points. All of you know about the 47 million uninsured. But probably what you don't know, which is more important, is that 70 to 75% of the uninsured are either full-time workers or dependents in the household of full-time workers. This fact is, it seems to me, completely un-American. The rules of this country are, if you play by the game, you pay taxes, you work hard, you are supposed to get the fruits of that. And the fruits include things like health care insurance. That someone can work full-time, sometimes two jobs, and not get health coverage seems to me just completely outside the American social contract. And to boot, we have 9 million children who don't have health coverage. How can we expect them to pay for it? Seems to me just disgraceful that we tolerate that. Cost control. In the United States, in 2006, the last year for which we have reliable data, we spent $2.1 trillion. That's how many zeros are in trillion. I did not hold my finger down too long. It is an astounding number. You look in your wallet, it's one out of every $6 just goes to healthcare. Now, I have given this talk at a number of illustrious venues, Harvard Medical School, Yale, University of Michigan Medical School, Northwestern, and many places. Incredibly smart people. And I can confirm one overwhelming fact. No one I've talked to has a good grasp for a trillion. So I have a little quiz for you. There are several quizzes in this talk. How big is a trillion? So we'll start out simple. How long ago was a million seconds? No mathematicians here and no budding management consultants. It was last week. A billion seconds? Someone quickly would say 1,000 weeks ago, right? That's pretty good. It's right around about when Richard Nixon resigned the White House. A trillion seconds ago. 30,000 BC. That's 14,000 years before the first human stepped foot on the North American continent. They just discovered some bones in Oregon. It is just a phenomenal number, and we're spending two of those every year. We're spending so much, you know, we're worried about China overtaking the United States. We're spending more on healthcare than the entire Chinese GDP. For 1.2 billion people. We spend more on healthcare in this country than the French and Spanish GDPs combined. It is just such a huge number, it's almost impossible to get your mind around it. And you know what? That's only part of the problem. The other part of the problem is what I call the tsunami graph. This is healthcare spending into the future, 75 years into the future. And if you look at the end of that graph, we are soon going to be only two types of people in this country, patients and healthcare workers. You're either a patient or you're a healthcare worker, and there's nothing left in the economy. Clearly, that can't happen. But this tells you the kind of curve we are on. If we don't do anything, there will be nothing else in the federal budget by 2028, just healthcare. Well, there's two parts to this that you need to focus on. One is we spend a lot of money because of waste, and a dominant part of that waste, but by no means the only part, is administrative waste. Mainly a defective insurance market with underwriting for each separate company, sales, brokers' commissions, marketing, and billing. The McKinsey Global Institute estimated that's at least $75 billion a year for no health benefit. The cost increase, the sort of graph up and up and up. The Congressional Budget Office did a study and agrees with several previous studies by economists that those cost increases, half of them are driven by technology. The dominant factor in that cost increase year over year is the development of new and expensive technologies, and just as importantly, the diffusion of existing technologies to patients who have less and less indication for that intervention, and therefore it has less and less benefit for them. Well, I just want to focus for a second on the administrative side. Two economists out at Stanford wrote, "The need for more than 850 insurance companies to see and contract with millions of employers in this country. Underwriting each one adds greatly to administrative costs. Typically, administrative costs are on the order of 11% of premium, and this does not include the cost to employers to purchase and manage the healthcare spending. To understand how this could be different, consider that Kaiser Permanente signs only one annual contract for the coverage of more than 400,000 employees and their dependents with CalPERS, that's a California public employee retirement program. And the administrative costs are on the order of 0.5% of premium. The difference between 11% and 0.5% of premium, that 10.5%, that is certainly waste with no health benefit. That is purely a result of trying to underwrite for each individual employer, sell them, and collect the bills. Delivery system. We have each year 1 billion office visits to doctors in offices. A third of those are to solo practitioners working alone, not administratively, clinically, or fiscally related to another doctor. Another third are to groups of doctors of four or fewer. Now, it's very hard to care for people with chronic illnesses, especially multiple chronic illnesses, when you're working separately. The typical Medicare beneficiary sees 7 physicians, including 5 specialists, in a year. And if you have 2 chronic conditions on Medicare, you see, on average, 15 doctors in a year. How can you provide good medicine that way? A RAND study, which looked at Medicare patients being discharged from hospitals, assessed the quality of the care they got on 9 really simple measures. I'm not talking about complicated surgeries or chemotherapy. I'm talking about things like, was their blood pressure measured and were they on the right medication? Was their cholesterol measured and were they on the right cholesterol medication? Did they get a vaccine against pneumonia? And the chances of people getting getting all of those 9 simple things, about 50%. The flip of a coin. And you know what? They redid this study for kids, and it was even worse. 46% of the time, kids got the right proven therapy. We also provide a lot of unproven therapies. You heard that I'm a breast oncologist, so I will pick on the prostate doctors. 210,000 American men will get early stage prostate cancer this next year. They can get one of 3 kinds of treatment. They can either get watchful waiting, where you just follow them because it's more likely they'll die with it rather than from it. Or they can get a prostatectomy, get the prostate removed. Or they can get radiation therapy. And inside of radiation therapy, there are now actually 4 and as many as 5 therapies. I've listed 4 of them here. There's 3D conformal radiation, which is you get a CAT scan and you mold the radiation to it. There's brachytherapy, where you put little seeds into the prostate of radiation. There's IMRT, intensity modulated radiation therapy, where you give radiation from 360 degrees around them. And there's proton beam, where you don't send electrons at them, which is typical radiation, but you send protons. These machines cost north of $100 million. They have to be encased in a football-sized building. And you can see the prices, substantial variation in the prices. Well, what's the variation in the outcomes, you might ask? I can't tell you. And you know what? No one in the world can reliably tell you, because there's never been a head-to-head comparison between these 4 different kinds of radiation therapy. At best, we have single institution, in my experience, studies. I can assure you of one thing. No radiation oncologist thinks that there is a survival difference between these 4. And I can guarantee that to you because last year, exactly at this time, I went to the annual meeting of radiation oncologists, threw up this slide, and say, one of you, just one of you 3,000 people, come up and tell me I'm wrong. No one took the bait. And in question and answer, no one said that data is wrong. At best, there is a 10% absolute decline in side effects, mainly impotence and proctitis. Now, I ask you, is that worth $70,000 price difference? Just look at the nearest man next to you and ask yourself, would I pay $70,000 for him to have less side effects and no survival benefit? I won't ask you. I'll continue with the theme of prostate doctors. Last year at this time, the Journal of Clinical Oncology published a study that among men 66 years and older with lower moderate grade prostate cancer, not receiving radiation or prostatectomy, these are men in general who have very good prognoses and are, again, not going to die from the disease, a third of them received androgen deprivation therapy, either an actual surgical castration or a chemical castration with drugs that block testosterone. There is not a shred of evidence that this prolongs life, and we know that it makes their quality of life worse because they become impotent. It is not recommended by either the AUA, that's the Urological Association, or other cancer guidelines. And what's even more disheartening to me is that academic doctors were barely better than community practitioners. This is pure wasteful therapy. And let's talk about the drag on the economy. When the University of Virginia provides your law faculty with health insurance, it's about $12,000 for a family plan. To translate that, that is like them hiring another worker at minimum wage for a whole year. So to give your faculty health insurance, it's like hiring two people. You want to know why there's a lot of outsourcing and offshoring? It's to get out of that hiring of a second worker. Linking health insurance to employment, which is a complete accident of history, a complete result of the World War II wage and price controls, has created serious labor management problems. Almost all strikes over the last decade have been about health insurance. The only one which hasn't was the Hollywood writers' strike, and no one has any idea what that was about. My youngest brother is an agent, and he still can't tell me what it was about. It also causes a lack of portability, because you can't switch jobs or start your own company and retain that health insurance. It, as I mentioned, induces outsourcing and offshoring. And it also suppresses wages, because when they pay you more for health care, they can't raise your salary so much. So as Vladimir Lenin would say, what should be done? That is the question. Well, you heard that I work for the U.S. government. I told you there'd be another quiz here. We didn't do so well on that trillions one, so we'll start with this. Everyone knows this guy. Who's this guy? HHS Secretary Mike Levin. Who said that? Raise your hand, please. You get them. Usually in a crowd this size.
We got a lot of them.
Oh, okay. We got a lot of them. I go to most places, 1% to 2% positive response here. That's it. This guy actually oversees more money in the federal budget than any other secretary of an agency or department. He oversees over $1 trillion. This guy, in this audience, no one knows. Yeah. He's the acting director of the NIH, an epidemiologist. You might ask, why is an epidemiologist running the National Institutes of Health? I think it's a great question. Okay. All right. Now, if you hang out in Washington or read the papers or are a sort of policy wonk, you know that there are hundreds of healthcare reform proposals. Hundreds. As a matter of fact, the Center for American Progress, which some of you may know, is a Democratic think tank in Washington run by John Podesta. In the last 18 months, they've issued three different healthcare reform proposals. And it's not because one was implemented and they needed to sort of tweak it. You know, it's a way of getting news, right? You release a new proposal, the press covers you. You don't need to understand hundreds of healthcare reform proposals, because all reform proposals are simply one of four flavors. That's all there are. There are not a zillion variations. Our proposal is the Guaranteed Healthcare Access Plan. That ours, by ours I mean a plan I've developed with Victor Fuchs, who's a health economist out at Stanford, former president of the American Economics Association, one of the original healthcare economists in this country. When he started in the late 50s and early 60s, he was one of three economists who thought healthcare was important to think about. Our plan is very similar, although I think simpler and easier to understand than the Wyden-Bennett bill put forward by Ron Wyden, senator from Oregon, and he's teamed up with the Republican Bob Bennett from Utah. In addition, there's incrementalism, which we'll talk about. There's an individual and or employer mandate, what they're doing in Massachusetts. And there's single payer options. Now, Like Fox News, I am going to give you a fair and balanced account of these four options. So let's first talk about our plan. You can best understand it as having 10, on the basis of 10 principles. First, every American receives a certificate or voucher to obtain a standard benefits package through an insurance company or health plan. The standard benefits package is modeled on the benefits plan that congressmen and senators get, and as a matter of fact, that I get. Every federal employee has as an option. Health plans and insurance companies have the guarantee issue, that is, if you come with the certificate, they have to enroll you. They cannot exclude any pre-existing condition. In return for that, those two requirements, all Americans are in the system for them, and they get what's called a risk-adjusted premium. That is, they're paid more to take care of sick patients, those with diabetes or heart disease or cancer or AIDS, and less to take care of your types, healthy 20-year-olds. Every American would have free choice of any qualified plan. Most of you get choices between 5 and 8 plans in most cities. If you're in New York, you might get up to 20 plans. If you're in rural North Dakota or South Dakota, there's simply going to be one plan. You don't sign up, the regional health boards assign you randomly to a plan. There's no premium, no deductible, no barrier. You got to be in the system. Those certificates or vouchers are funded by a dedicated value-added tax, which begins at 10% without Medicare and Medicaid included and will go up to 15 or so percent. It's dedicated in two ways. The first way is all of the VAT goes to healthcare. So we know exactly as a public what we're paying for it. It's dedicated also in the sense that no external funds are going to be added from general revenue. So you can't siphon it off to Social Security or defense or the environment or highways, and you don't get extra from general revenue. Fourth, Americans have freedom to purchase with after-tax dollars additional services. You want a wider selection of doctors or hospitals? You can buy it. You want complementary and alternative medicine. You want more mental health benefits. You want concierge medicine and have your doctor make house calls. You can buy it, but with after-tax dollars. No supplementation for that. The private sector, insurance companies, health plans, organize and deliver care. The tax exemption for employment-based insurance is eliminated. So right now, your lovely faculty who get their health insurance from the University of Virginia pay no income tax and no payroll tax on that benefit. That tax benefit is worth more than $210 billion to the federal treasury. It is the single largest tax benefit in the tax code. It is double the mortgage deduction, and we're getting rid of it to try to get rid of employment-based coverage. Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP, and all other government programs are phased out. That means that people who are in them don't get thrown out, but no new enrollees. So if someone turns 65 when the Guaranteed Health Care Access Plan is in place, they stay in our plan, they don't go into Medicare. These plans will be phased out in a maximum of 10 years. Administration and oversight are by a national health board and 12 regional boards modeled on the Federal Reserve System. That means the governors are appointed for long, staggered terms, cannot be removed for political reasons. They have their own independent funding source through the VAT. They set the standard benefits package. They oversee the insurance exchanges. They regulate health plans. They report to Congress. An Institute of Technology and Outcomes Assessment is established to do two things. One, to evaluate new technologies, whether they're drugs or devices or new procedures, to see what their benefits are, how much they cost, how much they compare to others. And they disseminate patient outcomes data. They collect data from the health plans on how the patients are doing, so on diabetics, maybe what their hemoglobin A1C is, how many hospitalizations have their diabetic patients had, what's the 30-day mortality after heart attacks, and they rank and report those data. Finally, there's a Center for Dispute Resolution and Patient Safety, which again does two things. They adjudicate patient claims of injuries and compensate them. And to prevent malpractice, they actually promote, both with money and with data recording, proven patient safety measures. Right now, we don't have a single organization that is responsible, either accountable or have any resources to implement proven patient safety measures. And there are a lot of patient safety measures that have not been widely implemented. So you might ask, how does the Guaranteed Healthcare Access Plan stack up against the 7 goals I mentioned at the start? Well, first, regarding guaranteed coverage for all Americans. All 100% of Americans are covered, regardless of income, age, job status, health status, or any other measure you can think of. Everyone's in. You get the voucher, there's no premium, no deductible barrier. And even if you don't sign up, you get assigned. You can't be out of this system. There is no crack to fall through. Controlling costs, we eliminate or reduce costs from insurance underwriting, sales, and marketing. Income-linked subsidies. Right now, for someone to get Medicaid, the state has to decide, are they income eligible? That is not a cheap process. That actually, on average in Medicaid, takes 2 months of premium. It's a very expensive process. Finally, businesses that now have to manage which health plan did you select, withhold money from your paycheck for the premiums, monitor all sorts of things, they're out of that business too. Integrated and high quality delivery system. Health plans have to provide the three I's, infrastructure, information systems, and incentives for integrated care. And they'll have a big incentive to do that. If they have to report their outcomes, that gives them a huge incentive to computerize their systems and to also integrate care to improve their outcomes. If they have to provide the standard benefits package for a fixed premium, it's going to give them a big incentive, again, to integrate care, to get rid of the wasteful care, and only to use cost-effective technologies. In addition, in the current system, your employer or the government decides which plan you go into. In our system, you decide where you want to go. You think that health plan isn't giving you good customer service? They're not doing what you want? You take your little certificate and you walk away and go to the plan you want. Freedom of choice. Americans can choose their doctor, they can choose their health plan, and they can choose whether to buy more services. Fair fiscal responsibility. Everyone pays a VAT. It's a very hard tax to evade. And the more you consume, the more you pay. The average American family, where the median income is $50,000, will pay $4,500 or less and get a benefit that's worth over $12,000. Malpractice reform, I mentioned about that. And helping the economy. Business will no longer pay for health care, eliminating the incentive to outsource and offshore and allowing the hiring of more workers. It reduces labor management conflict over health benefits, provides you as a worker complete portability. More importantly, one of the hidden things in our plan is the fact that state taxes, especially and some federal taxes, are going to decline. Right now, in state budgets, a third of the budget goes to health care between Medicaid, SCHIP, and insurance for state workers. In our plan, that goes away. Just imagine what happens to state taxes when you sort of cut out a third of the budget. I'm sure governors will retain some of it for services they haven't been able to provide, like education, reducing tuition at places like the University of Virginia, but they're going to have a huge tax break. So one thing you might be thinking is, this sounds a little too good to be true. It's got to be really expensive. So one question is this economically feasible? What I put up here, the last year again for which we have reliable data, is the 2006. What I put up here is what it costs to insure all Americans, excluding the Medicare population, 258 million Americans, excluding Medicare, because I assume you can fold in Medicare dollar for dollar. So employment-based coverage in 2006 was $723 billion. That includes what employers contributed and what workers contributed to the premium. Does not include out-of-pocket expenses. Medicaid and SCHIP, $269 billion, excluding the nursing home payments. And then there's a variety of safety net programs like pregnant women and children's programs, vaccination programs that would be eliminated. At least $10 billion and maybe as much as $50 billion in that pot. Altogether, that's $1,000 billion or $1 trillion. So I would suggest to you that a test of economic feasibility for the Guaranteed Healthcare Access Plan is, can we get all 258 million Americans under 65 covered for that amount of money? And the answer? Come on, you guys are flunking. Obviously, yes, I wouldn't put it up if it weren't yet. I'm not that stupid. So on this chart, you see the population of individuals under 65 and families under 65, the 258 million number here. You multiply these families by 3.7, I think it is, in the household. Here's the annual premium for the government program, the high-end Blue Cross Blue Shield preferred provider organization that I sign up for in Illinois at the 2006 rates charged to the government. And you can just multiply those out, and you see it comes to $944 billion. Now, you are lawyers and not doctors and not public health officials, so you might not know or might not think, well, you got federal employees, that's the premium, but we're trying to include the uninsured and the Medicaid population in here. It turns out that the Medicaid population in particular is a lot sicker than a federal employee. Federal employees, you know, they're working for the government is already a test of your health. If you're really sick, you really can't hold down a full-time job. And it is true that the Medicaid population uses a lot more healthcare services than workers, because many of them are on Medicaid because they cannot work. So to this number, you have to add about $50 billion. And if you're interested, I can tell you how we come to that calculation. Adding that up, our plan costs $994 billion, call it $1 trillion, exactly what we're spending today, and we can get all 47 million uninsured into the system for the exact same amount. How? Well, a large part of that is the insurance wasted money that we get rid of. Because a federal employee health benefit plan covers 8.9 million people, workers and their dependents, and has incredibly low overhead. But economic efficiency is not just can you cover everyone today, it's do you have a serious cost control strategy. Now, I don't think there is one magic bullet to cost control. It's going to take doing lots of things in the same direction. So we have a number of strategies pulling in the same direction. We have what I like to call the rheostat based on the dedicated VAT. If all you can spend is the VAT, it provides a hard backstop against how much you can spend. Any increase in benefits has to be matched by a willingness of the American public to increase that VAT rate. Will that happen? Well, we know that people spend more the richer they are. The more GDP you get per person, the more likely you spend an increasing amount on health care. But given how much the American public loves taxes, this is not going to happen every year. Second, requiring additional services to be paid for with after-tax dollars will present the American public with scrutiny of what additional stuff they're buying and whether it's worth it. Competition among health plans is going to lead to a heavy emphasis on cost-effective care and keep rates down. Sound skeptical? Look at the Part D competition this year. 85% of people are in one of the big eight plans. The bids came in this year 26% below expectations, mainly because of competition and trying to figure out how to do it cheaper. But the most important mechanism, in my view, is that systematic technology and outcomes assessment. Why? It'll do two things. One, it'll give information to the insurers, to doctors, to hospitals about what really works and not just cover things without data. Second, and more importantly, it sends a message upstream to drug manufacturers, device manufacturers, to people developing new procedures. It gives them predictability. You know, today, the drug companies are working on drugs that are going to hit the market in 2018, 2020, 2023. They have to make estimates of the net present value of something in the future. How big is the market going to be? How much in terms of price will the market bear? What's the competition going to be? The thing they need the most is predictability. And this gives them predictability. How likely do you think under this system they're going to develop a drug for $50,000 that extends the life of a cancer patient a month, 2 months, 4 months? Ain't going to happen. They'll kill it in the bathwater way before it gets to the market. So how does the Guaranteed Healthcare Access Plan compare to the other three options? I told you that I would be fair and balanced. There are a lot of proposals for incremental reform. Expand the SCHIP program, that's the state's children health insurance program, to all children. Get all the hospitals and doctor's office wired with electronic medical records. Get everyone medical savings account for catastrophic coverage. It's important to know that these proposals fail to achieve any one of the seven goals. They don't get you universal coverage. They don't get you cost control. They don't improve the delivery system. That's not the reason. The reason they're proposed is because they're politically feasible. We can get them passed in Congress. Well, you might not be so sure of that after seeing what happened to the S-CHIP bill. But that is the motivation. No one says this is the best policy. McCain's healthcare proposal, and I put it up here as an illustrative example of these kind of approaches, was based upon three principles. First, people would pay a tax on their insurance provided by their employers, and I mentioned to you why you might want to have that. Instead, he would provide people with a tax credit of $5,000 for a family or $2,500 for individuals, however they got their insurance. You get it through your employer, you get the $5,000 tax credit. If you buy it on your own, you get the $5,000 tax credit. And to facilitate purchases by individuals, he would allow interstate purchase of insurance. So you in Virginia could buy insurance companies for insurance from a company maybe in Utah or Arizona, typically places that have less regulation, less protections of the public. In addition, his plan is, did I miss a slide? I thought there was a slide in between. His plan is incrementalism par excellence. It doesn't solve any of the problems. Let's go to the second proposal, mandates. Mandates are based upon three principles. First is the mandate. Require all individuals or employers to buy health insurance, even if only catastrophic coverage through a high deductible plan. Now, in the 1990s, the preference was employers. That's the Bill Clinton plan was an employer mandate. In the 2000s, you know, employers are no longer seen, it's individual mandate. Second plank is to have these insurance exchanges where all the insurance companies have to offer the same package and they compete for people in them. This lowers, again, the rate or the administrative cost. Finally, if you're going to require people to get coverage, even if you have the insurance exchanges at lower cost, you have to provide subsidies. And the typical plans have subsidies to lower income people up to 300% of poverty. For those of you who aren't up on it, poverty level in this country for a family of four is $20,000. 300% of poverty is $60,000 a year. That's a majority of the families in the country who get a subsidy. Or you subsidize small businesses to provide insurance. Now, Obama's plan is a version of mandates. His plan mandates children get coverage. Everyone under 18 has to have coverage. And that large employers have to either cover their workers or pay a penalty so that their workers can get coverage through a other plan. Notice there is no mandate for adults, and you may remember that debate between Mrs. Clinton and Obama about the size and scope of their mandate. That was it. They were arguing about, do you mandate for everyone over 18? It's a pretty minor debate, to be honest. Everything else in their plan was pretty similar. The insurance exchange, he has a national insurance exchange offering a choice of health plans where everyone has to offer the same plan. And to compete with the private insurers, the Aetnas, the WellPoints, the Blue Cross and Blue Shields of the world, he wanted to create a government national health plan open to people who don't have employer-based insurance or any public program or a small business. They have to offer the federal employee health benefit program as their standard, and this program had to guarantee issue and have no pre-existing conditions. And finally, he had subsidies, two forms, a 50% tax credit to small businesses who provide health insurance to offset their costs and encourage them to provide it, and then income-linked subsidies for people to buy into the national health plan. Then he had these other provisions, electronic medical records, pricing transparency so you'd know what your CAT scan costs, reimportation of drugs so Canadians would have a good excuse to come across the border with pockets bulging with pills, and other doodads. This list is like motherhood and apple pie. Everybody has the exact same list. McCain had this list too, and I was looking for that slide. Now, I told you I'd be fair and balanced. Mandates is best thought of as a fill-in-the-cracks proposal. It basically relies on the current system and tries to make as few changes to the current system as possible to get as close to universal coverage as possible. Now, I told you I'd be fair and balanced, and you might think those are my words. Wrong. Those are the words of Jonathan Gruber, who's the MIT health economist who developed the Massachusetts plan. He describes his own plan as a fill-in-the-cracks plan. Now, there are certain, you might ask how this ranks against the seven goals. First, coverage gets to 97%, never passes that. Why? Because many of those people above 300% of poverty, above $60,000 for a family of four, but below $80,000, get no subsidy and yet have to buy a $12,000 insurance package. That is pretty difficult. And so what ends up happening is those people are declared, it's declared they're outside the mandate, it's unaffordable for them to buy health insurance. So you never get them in the system. In addition, there are a bunch of, 18 to 29-year-olds who think that they're immune, mainly young white males, who say, I'm not buying that coverage, even if it's mandated. Controlling costs, plan has no sustained cost control mechanism over time. And the preliminary experience in Massachusetts confirms these ideas. Before Massachusetts started the mandate, they had about 620,000 uninsured, 11% of the population. More than 200,000 people, actually now 400,000 people have signed up, but they haven't gotten the last 200,000. And that looks, I just actually had a dinner last Friday with one of the guys running the program. He says, it looks like we're never going to get that last 200,000. They get you to 90% coverage, but that is it. But the real problem was cost control, making it unaffordable for employers and putting the state in a difficult dilemma. Rising costs are going to mean that employers will pay the penalty rather than provide insurance to their workers. And the state, therefore, is going to have to provide more subsidies. Just think about the current or the upcoming recession. You're going to have a lot of employers facing low demand and really tight budgets. And one place they can cut is cut insurance. Then you're going to have 10, 11% unemployment. A lot of people the state's going to have to provide insurance for. Now you're sitting in the governor's chair in Massachusetts, and you got this big pool of uninsured you have to provide coverage for, whether because they're unemployed or their employers don't provide coverage. And you have a dilemma. Do you raise taxes and in a recession to pay for the subsidies, or you simply declare more and more people out of the mandate because it's unaffordable to them? You tell me what's going to happen. You don't have to tell me. Here is the head of the Massachusetts Insurance Exchange, known as the Connector. Massachusetts insurers plan to raise rates 10 to 12% next year, 2008, twice this year's national average. If we continue with double-digit inflation, I don't think health care reform is sustainable. As a matter of fact, Ezra Klein, who writes on health care for the Washington Monthly, called Massachusetts an unsustainable success. It's a success because it got a lot of people coverage, unsustainable, had no cost control, and you can't continue it. Let's finally talk about single payer. Goes by the moniker Medicare for All, which has been introduced by a number of people, or the Physicians Working Group of Single Payers, a group of doctors based in Boston, which has been advocating for a Canadian-style single payer plan. Again, it rests on three main principles. You get rid of the insurance companies, and you have a single national health plan that provides all Americans a comprehensive benefits package. You reduce administrative costs because you don't have those 11% insurance company costs. You have administrative costs at 3 to 4% of overhead, as Medicare does now, saving a lot of money. And finally, to keep costs under control for the future, you have negotiated fees and payments. You reimburse doctors fee for service the way current Medicare does, and you control the prices. You negotiate with hospitals a fixed operating cost. You negotiate, you establish a national formulary, and you negotiate with the drug companies for price. Since you're the single purchaser, you can put down the lock screws pretty tight. The best way to think of single payer reform is a radical reform of the financing system harnessed to the 19th century horse and buggy fragmented delivery system we have today. It doesn't do a darn thing to change the delivery system. The key problems are no integrated delivery system, no cost control or a failed cost control mechanism, and politicization of decision making. Again, I said that reform of the delivery system is going to require infrastructure for coordinated, integrated care, bring doctors and hospitals, home health care agencies, physical therapists, pharmacists all together. Information share systems, the shared electronic medical record, so they can all do things with guidelines, getting data back on how well you're performing. And finally, we know those two things aren't going to happen spontaneously. We know that by just looking at the current system. So you need incentives, money, to get everyone together. After all, doctors love working on teams, as long as they're the captain. So you have to do something to persuade them to work with others. Now, you can call the organization that's going to do that whatever you want. You can call it an integrator, an organizer. It's going to look a lot like an insurance company. But if there's one thing single-payer advocates hate, it's insurance companies. Second, they institutionalize a fee-for-service delivery system, which doesn't provide the infrastructure, is actually antithetical completely to integrated, organized care. The main mechanism of cost control in single-payer is price. They ratchet down the price on physicians, on hospitals, home health care agencies, drug organizations. Well, that is a completely failed cost control mechanism. We can see it in Medicare. We've been doing it for years, and it doesn't work. Providers figure out how to game the system. After all, most of you know, PV equals a constant, right? Some of you might have taken chemistry. You remember the universal gas law? Well, it also applies to doctors and lawyers and lots, right? You got price times volume equals income. Squeeze price, what do you think happens? Volume goes up because you got to maintain your income. And most people are not willing to have a drop in income. And that's exactly what happens. Squeeze down on price, pay less per unit, you get more units. Finally, there's politicization of decision-making. When single-payer advocates imagine the guy who's going to run their system, they imagine this guy. Uncle Teddy! But what happens if the administrator turns out to be this guy? Hal Luft, who's a health economist at UCSF and now moved to the Palo Alto Health Clinic, wrote in JAMA not too long ago, Medicare, which provides near-universal coverage to U.S. residents 65 years and older, is the prototypical single-payer model and routinely exhibits the problems of that model. Although permitted to arbitrarily set fees, Medicare has found it difficult to do so effectively. Across the board, fee changes elicit broad-based political reaction. Narrowly focused changes draw sub-rosa special interest lobbying. Patient advocacy groups, often supported by industry and specialty societies, encourage coverage for their specific favored service. Rather than market discipline, Medicare is subject to political manipulation and bureaucratic rigidity. Single-payer advocates envisioning an equitable and efficient healthcare system idealistically disregard the example of Medicare and the ethos of the U.S. political system. They have in their vision, insurance companies evil, drug companies evil. They fail to think through the institutional mechanisms you need to have a politically insulated group to really run the system carefully. This chart summarizes these reforms in a very important way. It is an important slide, probably the second most important slide of this talk. On this slide, the Lewin Group, which is an independent healthcare consulting group in Washington, has a model of how healthcare reform would work, how many more people would be covered, how much it would cost over time. It ran the McCain proposal through it, the Obama proposal through it, and the Wyden-Bennett bill as a surrogate for our plan. We haven't had ours run through it. And it is evaluated by coverage and cost. And you may have seen this about 2 weeks before the election. They released the results on the McCain-Obama plan. If you run through McCain's incremental reform, you get 21 million additional people covered at a cost of $2 trillion over 10 years, or $200 billion a year. You run the more expansive mandates proposal by Obama, you get between 27 and 34 million, depending on where you put the cutoff for large employers, insured, and you get at a cost of $120 billion per year, $1.2 trillion over 10 years. You run the Wyden bill through it, which is very similar to ours, Guaranteed Healthcare Access Plan. You get all Americans covered, and you save $1.4 trillion over 10 years. Why is this slide so important? More reform is cheaper. Completely antithetical to the thinking in Washington. Washington thinks more reform is more expensive. More reform in healthcare redoes the system, makes it much more efficient, allows you to save money. We have to get Washington to realize this is true. Well, I'm going to end my talk talking about the thing I love most, politics. Now, I've talked to you about healthcare reform. There are many, many barriers to healthcare reform. After all, we've been trying this since 1913 and failed every time. Why? Well, the first, I demonstrated at the start here, the rule of satisfaction. You guys are well insured. You like your doc. You think the system's broken, but you like your doc. Well, 85% of the Americans have health insurance. They like their situation. They might think the system's bad, but they say, oh, change the system, but keep mine the same. Very hard to do that. Then there's the James Madison rule of government. I should be talking about this in Virginia. My God. Right? Madison wrote the Constitution with a goal in mind. Prevent tyranny. Make it really hard. He would be proud of gridlock in Washington. That's how he designed the Constitution. Right? You gotta start a bill in the House committee or in the Senate committee. They hold hearings and they pass the bill out. Goes to the full Senate and full House. They have to pass it. Of course, they're two different bills. You need a conference committee. Then you need to go back to the houses. Then it goes to plenty of places to screw it up and prevent anything from being enacted. Why don't we have big health bill, big bills coming out of Congress regularly? Madison knew why. My favorite is, of course, the Machiavelli rule of reform. There is nothing more difficult to carry out, he wrote to the prince, nor more doubtful of success, nor more dangerous to handle than to initiate a new order of things. For the reformer has enemies in all those who would profit by the old order, and only lukewarm defenders in all those who would profit by the new order. After all, if you're part of the old order, you know what you're going to lose. The new order, it's a little hypothetical. How do I know it's going to work that way? I'll sit on the sidelines. Maybe it won't pass. I don't want to create enemies. Finally, there's the Stuart Altman rule of second best. Now, some of you may be diehard single-payer advocates. Some of you may be like Obama and the Massachusetts mandates. Maybe I've even convinced some of you to the Guaranteed Health Care Access Plan. God forbid any of you are incrementalists. But we all have a second best, which is do nothing. And that's why it has been very difficult to get anything enacted. In California, the Schwarzenegger bill died because people had a second best, which was do nothing. But I am not a pessimist. I am inherently, constitutionally an optimist. The people who study American political institutions, John Kingdon, who just retired from the University of Michigan Political Science Department, wrote that to get major change in America, you need four things to coalesce. Actually, he said three things, and being haughty, I thought I could add a fourth. The first is you need a problem that attracts widespread public and political attention. Second, you need a proposal to solve that problem that's agreed upon by the major actors. Third, you need a champion who will champion that vigorously through thick and thin, pushing it hard. And finally, you need a transforming political event that creates an open policy window through which you can shove this proposal. On the problem, I do think we have understanding of the problem. Of course, people can understand it more subtly. They can understand the difficulties better of the delivery system. But I don't think our problem is that we don't understand our healthcare system is broken. Policy, at the moment, we don't have that consensus. We did have McCain and Obama differ. We have the Wyden bill, which is even more different. And many key stakeholders have not gotten off the fence and said what they're for. Let me identify a few of them. Business. Earlier this week, I was at something the Wall Street Journal ran, which was the CEO Council, where they brought together 100 CEOs of major companies like FedEx, Pfizer, Novartis, Dow, Goldman Sachs. And they asked them to make proposals in four areas, including healthcare. They had nothing interesting to say about healthcare. And what they did say revealed they know nothing about healthcare, and they are uninterested. Similarly, I'm not sure why governors of most states haven't gotten more on the bandwagon. They are being completely handcuffed by the increase in healthcare costs, prevented from initiating new initiatives because more and more money has to go to healthcare, and yet you haven't heard them scream very loud. And finally, there are patient advocates. They are getting worried by the increase in costs. They are getting worried that maybe they're not getting such high quality, but they have yet to coalesce around proposals. We have a lot of champions, but those big three champions haven't gotten into the game. Finally, we need a transforming political event. By definition, these are unpredictable. And not only are they unpredictable to you and me, they're unpredictable to politicians. These things come out of the blue. And interestingly, we're more able to predict them as laymen than politicians are, according to most studies of this. I think, and until 3 or 4 months ago, I was actually saying we've got to wait till 2013 before we have healthcare reform, because we don't have agreement on a policy. I've changed my tune in the last few months. actually beginning in September when I wrote my first editorial on this. I think we've had one transforming event already. The election of Barack Obama, with two Confederate states voting for a black man, is a major transforming event in this country. But the financial crisis may offer another one, and let me give you seven or eight different reasons for that. First, when you socialize the U.S. banking system, you buy up Freddie, you buy up Fannie, you buy up AIG, you give money and buy stock. The government buys stock in Chase Manhattan and Wells Fargo and all those banks. How can you talk about socialized medicine more any more credible? You know, when Giuliani in the campaign said, that's socialized medicine, he'd just be laughed out of court now. So it allows us maybe to have a more intelligent debate about health care reform. Second, when you spend $700 billion on the banks and $150 billion on just one company, spending $200 billion suddenly looks cheap. It's all a matter of perspective in Washington. You're writing checks, just add another check. Third, in the moment when Americans are feeling oppressed by the financing and the uncertain financial future, when they're worried if they're going to be unemployed and maybe lose their coverage, they're going to be looking for financial stability. And one key element of that is health care insurance. Third, because they want security, they may be willing to accept something more basic rather than the gold-plated, comprehensive Cadillac of health care plans. Fifth, employers faced with slimming margins, maybe even losses, may be suddenly willing to let the government do more, go against their ideology for the moment. Sixth, given the debt pressures because of all these bailouts, and the slide I showed you about more reform being cheaper, you might get Congress moving towards more reform. Let me mention two more that are not on this slide that have happened in the last 3 days. Yesterday, it was announced that Peter Orszag will be head of the Office of Management and Budget. Probably none of you know who Peter Orszag is. Any of you know? He used to run the Congressional Budget Office, and before that he was at Brookings. He is one of the smartest economists in Washington, and he has spent the last few years as he's been head of the Congressional Budget Office pounding away about how serious health care costs are for the U.S. government. He knows a lot about health care costs. Having him in the OMB means they will not be allowed to take their eye off health care. And finally, at this CEO council that the Wall Street Journal ran, the last speaker happened to be my brother. And he was being interviewed, and he was trying desperately not to make any news. He said that about four times in that interview. And he said something really important, which wasn't very well covered. I've been pounding away at him for a long time about the following. I work, as I mentioned, with Vic Fuchs, and Vic Fuchs has been renowned for the following statement. We will get health care reform in this country when one of three things, and then he added a fourth, happens. We have a major depression, we have a major war, we have major civil unrest, or we may have a major flu pandemic that causes serious strain on the healthcare system. And then he used to say, quietly, and under this president, we might even get all four at the same time. And I've been pointing this out to my brother, and he said at this conclave of CEOs, he says, you know, under normal times, you can only get incremental reforms, but under unusual times, you can throw the ball long, all the way down the field. So he's finally understood that it might be possible with the financial crisis to throw the ball on healthcare all the way down the field. And that gives me a lot of hope. Thank you very much. Now, if you're interested in being engaged in the healthcare guarantee, two guys in Seattle, unrelated to me, have put up this website, healthcareguarantee.org, with some more information. If you want some more sort of technical policy, wonkish stuff related to things like tech assessment or the taxes used or administration or legal reforms that might be important, you can go to freshthinking.org. Those papers are thick, 25-page, single-space thing. If you're insomniac and you need to go to sleep, great place to head out. And that's the book. Thank you very much.